Well, I'm very delighted to be here on this occasion. That the this is a regular event every month. The second Wednesday of the month, Sangha members from Abhayagiri Monastery come down and say help to lead a gathering here. And since I was in the country at this time for a conference in San Francisco on mindfulness, and then had the ordination ceremonies up at Abhayagiri yesterday, last night. It was a very neat fit for me to come along to Yoga Mendocino this evening. And when Mary and Maggie were in touch with me about the possibilities of this event, then they were asking about a possible theme. So I like to choose things that are timely, and so having seen the news from overseas, I live in England, so which is a very soggy country, cool and soggy England. England's green and pleasant land. So then the news of the big drought that has been afflicting the West Coast and California in particular, the absence of snowpack and the effects of that absence of the water element that popped into my mind as a possible theme, also because of the different, say, layers of meaning or the different areas of reflection that one can explore in relationship to that. The choosing the word thirsty as a title is also it's a very close to the center of the Buddha's teachings, because in the Pali language the word for thirst is tanha, which is also the word for craving. So and this is what the Buddha highlighted in the Four Noble Truths in his core teaching on liberation. The Buddha pointed to tanha, or thirst, as the cause of discontent, the root cause of disharmony, discontent, dissatisfaction in the heart. So not particularly thirst for fluids, but the quality of craving in the heart. So it's kind of interesting that he uses that the physical sensation of thirstiness to reflect that craving of the heart. So I haven't been living here, so I haven't been close to a lot of the particular details of the drought and its effects. And so, but I can certainly see the landscape around, and I lived here long enough to get a sense of what it's like when things are really cooking. A few summers ago, up at Abhayagiri Monastery, it was I think it was over 110 for about 3 weeks in a row. It hit I think 123 3 days in a row was the peak. We had full-grown trees dying from the heat, and some of you will probably have been here during that time, and the that impactful presence of the environment and that parching of the land is something that's, it affects us on a very deep level, a bone deep level. But in terms of spiritual practice and Dharma teachings, I thought it'd be most helpful to speak not just about the external environmental side, but also to see addressing the other dimension of it, and how we relate to that inner quality of thirsting or craving. When it's like right now, I'm feeling hot. Probably most of us here, there's a feeling of heat, sweatiness, and in that analysis of the cause of suffering, or why we are, say, not happy all of the time, the Buddha lays out a particular way of of exploring or examining that situation. And what he points to is that in some of his teachings is how when we have a body, have a mind, then naturally that gives rise to feelings. We've got nerves. They have the capacity to create feelings of pleasure, pain, and neutral feelings. So if we are attentive, we will notice that we can feel quite comfortable, but the mind can be at peace with that. We can have a pleasant feeling, and the mind, we can enjoy that pleasant feeling, a beautiful sound or a lovely taste or physical comfort, physical delight. And we can just enjoy that and not make anything out of it. But usually what happens is that pleasant feeling gives rise to, this is good, more. And on the other end of the scale, or the sort of the flip side of that, is we can experience painful feeling where we're experiencing physical difficulty and discomfort, and it's really what we don't like. And we can also be at peace with that. We can know this is a painful feeling, this is uncomfortable, this is unlikable, but also not making a problem out of it. But when there is a lack of clear seeing, a lack of clear understanding, then that I don't like turns into I can't stand this, I got to get out of here, this is awful, I can't bear it. That the that dislike turns into to hating and fearing and resenting. So this is a dynamic I thought it would be useful to talk about, because that that bridge between I don't like and I can't stand, or I like and I want, that is a point at which we can make a big difference in our lives. And probably this is familiar territory to many of us here. This is such a central theme within spiritual practice, meditation, but I felt it was good to reiterate, you know, same old tune. Like one of the favorites, like breathing, you know, it is the same old thing, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. But it's kind of, even though it's the same old thing, there's a great richness, and there's a chemistry to that that is that's intrinsically transformative. So even though we might have heard these teachings or these ideas over and over, then the bringing it to mind and reflecting on it and seeing how we actually handle it is, I find it is very, very valuable. Sometimes we can have heard the same teaching 100 times over. You know, you read the same Dhamma book. Maybe you even edited the book yourself. And then you read it again 20 years later and you go, wow, that wasn't there before. I've done this many times myself. And you think, I'm sure that wasn't in the original edition. And you go back and look, there it was, even in your own books. You know, like, that's really clever. I never said that. And you go back and like, lo and behold, yes, you did. Like, oh, that's quite good. Did I really say that? So to get a sense of that, this is where, in a sense, the feeling of like or dislike, to know that as one thing, and to see the transformation into the craving or that thirsting, the tanha coming into being. Because when we are able to bring attention to the simplicity and directness of feeling, there's an innocence there. There's a lack of agitation in the heart, even with quite painful feelings. And but yet, as soon as the mind goes to, I can't stand it, I don't want this, I've had enough, then that agitation begins, and that the Buddha points to that very shift, that crossing that bridge. That's where the trouble starts. That's where the discontent and disharmony in our life really is. It's not that discontent comes from always having, from not having pleasant experiences, but rather the discontent comes from the attitude we have towards the unpleasant experiences and also to the pleasant ones. So just to stick with the unpleasant for the time being, you know. So there's this wonderful teaching, again, a very simple and direct teaching that the Buddha gave called the arrow, that I like to to recount. And this is the Buddha was a soldier before he was a monk, so he uses quite a few military analogies. And he uses the analogy of a soldier on the battlefield. He said, a soldier is on the battlefield, and the soldier gets shot by a single arrow. He said, nobody can avoid that first arrow. We're all in that same position. We're all going to get hit by that first arrow. If we have a body and a mind, we have feelings. And no matter how much you try to protect yourself from painful feeling, you're always going to have some kind of discomfort. Is there anybody here who's never experienced physical discomfort? Pretty safe bet, wasn't it? So, yeah, of course, it's 100%. And so the Buddha realized that and said, nobody can dodge the first arrow because we have a body, we have a mind, we feel things, and many of the things that we feel are uncomfortable. So no one can avoid the first arrow. But the second arrow is what the mind does with that. It's the resenting, the fearing, the negativity towards that painful feeling, hating it, wanting to get away from it, fearing what it's going to turn into, and the agitation that forms around that feeling. And he says, this is the second arrow, and the second arrow is negotiable. And when we talk about the Buddha's teaching, focusing on the ending of suffering, then it means the ending of the second arrow, not the first. So in case you thought, if you come along to these Buddhist meetings, you'll never have anything never have anything bad happen to you ever again, you're in the wrong hall. Because even the Buddha himself experienced chronic pain. He describes his own physical condition at the when he was an old man, at the age of 80. He said, my body is like an old cart held together with straps and ropes. And it's only held together through sort of makeshift repairs. So unless I absorb my mind into totally into emptiness, like if he's an ordinary waking consciousness, he said, I'm experiencing pain all the time. So he had seemingly chronic back pain. And so that's what, even the Buddha, totally enlightened being, had chronic back pain. So maybe that's not much consolation to some of you. But, I thought if I got enlightened, I wouldn't have this, all my ailments would go away. But I feel it's a bit, in a way, it's... The Buddha's teaching is less consoling. It's not a sort of "don't worry, everything's going to be fine" teaching. It's like, don't worry, you can make a big difference to how you relate to everything. It's that kind of a teaching. It's not consoling in terms of "oh, don't worry, you know, mummy will kiss it better and it'll go away," but rather, you have the capacity to change your attitude towards whatever life presents to you, regardless of what it is. So that the second arrow is that sense of it shouldn't be this way, when's it going to be over, this isn't fair, what can I do to get rid of this, I can't stand this. It's all of that fluster and agitation around what we experience, both physical and also mental. And so that this is an extremely valuable teaching, because what we're able to do is to realize that even when things are very uncomfortable, like feeling the heat right now, I would suggest that it's up to each one of us to make a problem out of it or not. Like, maybe when we were sitting here before the windows all got opened, we were thinking, oh, how long is this going to go on? When's he going to ring the bell? You know, these monks are real fanatics. They're going to give us a teaching and it's going to go on for hours and we're really going to be stuck. But if you saw that going on in your mind and you realize, well, hang on a minute, actually we've only been sitting here for 15 minutes, and the sittings are usually about half an hour, and he did say he was going to have a sitting for half an hour, so let's just chill, as it were. And then you think, well, it's just heat, you know. Maybe you actually go in a sauna to feel like this. You know, maybe you spent thousands of dollars building a sauna to feel like this. And so, which is, I'll go on to that the side of things in a minute. So in terms of the drought and dealing with the feelings of discomfort And the sense of how to relate to that. That's what I would suggest is that when we're dealing with the difficult emotions, just as dealing with physical pain, physical discomfort, we can see that we can not be reactive to it, but we can simply know this is the feeling of it. We realize that when there is that simplicity of feeling, the feeling is still there, it's still uncomfortable, the land is still dry, there's still an absence of water. But that attunement to the present, that capacity to be in tune with the feeling as it is, enables us to access our own responsivity, our own natural relatedness to the land around us, the people around us, the living creatures around us, the world around us. And so we find that we're able to act and speak in ways that really are in tune with what can be done and how we can help. Whereas if we are coming from a place of fear, of resentment, of those farmers, they're taking all the water, there's other people, they shouldn't be doing this, and we should be doing that, and we've got to... And all those natural and well-meant sort of reactive patterns, when that there's a reactivity against the discomfort of the effects of the drought, both locally and more widespread, then the choices that we make and the words that we say and the actions that we get involved in tend to create more agitation, more conflict, and more stress within ourselves and those around us. So I would suggest that the more that we are able to be fully attuned just to the simplicity of the feeling and not get caught in the craving, the thirsting, the desire for it to be one way, one particular way according to our preferences, then we're able to respond. We're able to act and engage in a way that is far more effective and far more helpful. Oftentimes, people misread Buddhist teachings and feel like, well, Buddhists are not supposed to have any feelings. We're supposed to just be peaceful. So. And it's like we're kind of trying to turn ourselves into zombies, you know, that don't have any feelings or wishes or can't take action or have initiative in our lives. But that's a radical misunderstanding. Rather, when we are able to free the mind from this reactive craving, and we are able to attune to feelings of pleasure or pain, feelings of our present situation in a direct and simple impersonal way, then our own capacity to act, our intrinsic relatedness to the people around us, the world around us, can act far more effectively and in tune with things. When there's something to say, then we say it. If there's nothing to say, then we keep quiet. If there's something that can be done, then we do it. If there's nothing to be done, then we can leave it alone, but without feeling any sense of lack or frustration on our part. Now that... when we are thinking about how to help other beings and, say, relating to others and dealing with, the drought situation on a level of compassion, then the important thing I would say, again, I'm not local anymore, and I'm not in the on the sort of California Water Board, but. Just to consider how we engage in compassionate action, that the important thing is to be ready to not create a sense of demand within ourselves or within others, and to learn how to act from a place of wisdom and mindfulness rather than a place of self-centered views and opinions. The more that I think it should be this way, I've got to make it like this and it shouldn't be like that, the more there is I and me and mine involved in those choices that are made, the more that there's a sense of demand on ourselves or demand on others, then I would say that the more we're out of tune with things, But the more that we are able to, say, let that self-centered perceptions be put aside, the more that we're able to notice those self-centered feelings and to leave them aside, then the more effective our actions are going to be. When we are dealing with these kind of situations, then it's along with emotion or feeling, it's also important to consider perception, that our the way that our mind forms the world, like, that says it should be this way. Like, so we look at a patch of grass and we say, my lawn. Well, from that particular piece of ground's point of view, it isn't your lawn, I would suggest. You know, the mind calls it, you know, my lawn or my my field or my tree, my garden, but it's only that because of the way the mind labels it. It from its own side, it is what it is. Right? Am I making sense? Yeah. So, for example, many years ago, I had a I lived in Northumberland, actually very near where Maggie was born. I lived in a little monastery in Belsay in Northumberland. And somebody gave me a plant, a little pot plant. And as you know, often in the shops, they force feed the plant so that they're sitting in the window looking all kind of bright and shiny, and someone is saying, buy me. And so someone then buys them, gives them to a monk. And then as soon as they've got out of the shop, then they get exhausted. So I was looking after this plant and it was getting quite distressed because it was starting to droop, and then all these green fly came on. I was trying to export the green fly on the little paintbrush and take them outside and put them elsewhere, and it was getting to be a full-time occupation because the green fly, as you know, they're pretty good multipliers. And so I was really stressing a lot trying to look after my plant that was really struggling with all these green fly chewing away on it. And this went on for about a week. And then I realized, well, maybe I shouldn't have a pot plant. Maybe I should have a green fly farm. So I just gave it a different name. And then it was fine. The green fly were happy. You know, like they were not being exported anymore. Their offspring were not being exiled, out to the garden. And they could happily chew away, and then their food source eventually demised. But in the meantime, they had a grand life. So in terms of dealing with the drought I feel it's also useful to consider our perceptions of what are we taking as fixed. Whether we say, oh, it should be this way. It shouldn't be that way. If it's like this, if this has died back, then it's bad. It's wrong. And it used to be all nice and green, and now it's all turned to dust. That's a bad thing. Well, sometimes it's just our perception that says that ought to be green, and that sometimes it's, well, in the natural cycle of things, some years are very, very dry, and then things die off, and they go back, and then they all go underground, and then they are in a state of, it's not hibernation, it's estivation. That's why things die off in the summer. It's called estivating, not hibernating. I learned that here in Northern California. Since we have this sort of hot winter of the summertime, things estivate. They die off for a while. And so that if we are ready to change our perceptions and our expectations, we can find that life gets can get a lot simpler and a lot lighter, just like with my little green fly farm. That if we simply change the way that we name things, or, and we are ready to challenge our perceptions, then and to say, well, why do I call it that? Or why do I think it's got to be that way? Who says it has to be held like that? Then we can undercut or cut away the basis for a lot of our stress and feelings of wrongness. Because essentially, when we consider dukkha, or that what we call suffering or discontent, it's that feeling of wrongness, of the universe is out of balance. It shouldn't be this way. This is not fair. It's not right. It shouldn't be this way. But I'm not condoning the the misuse of water, or people being greedy, or just happy that things die off, but rather just suggesting that we all look at the way that we name things, and to see how when the mind goes, well, it shouldn't be that way, or that's not right, I can't stand this, or that's really awful. Just to ask yourself, is that so? Is that so? Yeah, who says? Yeah, who says it can't be this way? It's like in this country, sometimes you get given very good. There, you find people who are very good makers of tea. not to be nationalistic about these things, but over the other side of the pond, there are more people who, say, quote unquote, know how to make tea. But you realize that that's a very British thing, about this is what tea is supposed to be like. And I remember there's this famous moment within the mythology of our community where Ajahn Sucitto, who's an English monk who some of you might know, when poured a cup of some brown fluid from the teapot at the Amaravati one morning, and he has a most extraordinary quality of inscrutability. He can have five sets of no expression apparent on his face at the same time. And he picked up his cup and he took a sip. And with five kinds of non-expression, he said, "This is not tea." But the interesting thing, and this happens reasonably often, just at this conference in San Francisco, I was given a cup of brown fluid at a certain point. And so my first thought was, oh, this tea is really dreadful. And then I thought, well, who says this is supposed to have a particular flavor? It is exactly what it is. I was thirsty. Here is brown fluid. It's not poisonous. I was thirsty. Now I'm not thirsty. Great. So I could have got all kind of huffy about how San Francisco State University catering department, they've really fallen down on the job. They didn't get a proper British tea maker in to help us overseas types. But then I could see, well, who says that there's this thing called tea? Yeah, as far as those bushes are concerned, sitting there on the ground, they're not particularly happy that people are coming along and plucking their leaves and boiling them. They're not there for us, right? The tea, all those tea bushes, Camellia sinensis, so happily sitting there soaking up the sun, they're not saying, oh, whoopee, I'm only existing so those humans can come and pick my leaves off. Hurrah, I'm so happy that they're coming and stripping all my baby leaves. I suspect that those tea bushes are not thinking that way, but we assume that they are. We assume that the world is there for us, or things are arranged according to our preferences and our perceptions. But in particular, when you have a stressed situation like this, or things are abnormal, looking in the creek beds and thinking, gee, there's just a tiny little puddle there, to rather than thinking, oh, that should be a full-scale river, or it shouldn't be quite this dry, or we should have had more rain last winter. We should. Just to apply that simple form of reflection. And this was a method of contemplation that Lumpo Cha, our teacher, used to emphasize. He was brilliant at these extremely pertinent and succinct meditation methods. So he would say, whenever your mind forms an opinion or a judgment, just ask yourself, is that so? As soon as you say, that's great, is that so? That's awful. Is that so? Oh, at last, it's finally going right. Is that so? Oh, no, it's all fallen apart. Is that so? And so when we apply that simple kind of reflection, bring that the attention to that, then again, it's not negating our feelings. It's not, say, pretending that, oh, therefore be passive or don't do anything or just shut up and be Buddhist. And switch off. Not at all. It's not negating our capacity to be involved. You're not trying to strangle your intrinsic relatedness to things. Rather, you're freeing up your intrinsic relatedness to things and enabling yourself to act more appropriately and more in tune with how things are. And so that's what I would suggest is very much a part of this. An even simpler form of reflection than asking, is that so, is the more challenging, so? Which is even more direct. Like, this is great, so? This is awful, so? Yeah. Oh, this is exactly what I wanted, so? It's all fallen apart, so? And that, it's in a similar way, puts into perspective the habits, the expectations, in a way holds up a mirror to our regular forms of judgment and the way that we frame, the way that we name the world, the way we create the world according to our perceptions. Maybe the last thing to share was interesting little comment or a story that was told by a venerable Mathieu Ricard, who's a very wonderful monk in the French monk in the Tibetan tradition, is giving a talk at this conference, and he's known as the happiest man in the world. You know, they've measured him; they've got scans to prove it. He is indeed the happiest man in the world. He was making jokes about it, which is quite funny. He's a very good photographer as well. He had this photograph of this very very cheerful Himalayan guy. And he says, this is really the happiest man in the world. And he had these sort of weird aviator sunglasses on, and he had two teeth and no others, like just sort of two fangs and this big grin and this sort of wrinkled Himalayan face. He says, this is really the happiest man in the world. He has not met an ophthalmologist or a dentist, but he is the happiest man in the world. So he was telling the story of how they were trying to measure him and they were doing experiments about empathy and altruism. He said, so we just want empathy. We want you to feel the suffering of others but not do anything about it. So you have to switch off your compassion. We just want empathy. So, and this is with like 200 electrodes on his head and being shoved in an MRI scanner, literally. And he said, oh, okay, I'll do my best. So they rig him up and he said that trying for an hour to just practice empathy, just to like feel the suffering of others, but not do anything with it, but just to appreciate the suffering of others. He said he was exhausted. He felt really burnt out, really frazzled at the end of that time. But he said, as soon as he was allowed to to practice altruism, to kind of develop compassion on account of that, along with the empathy, then he said then I was very happy. I could be there for 2-3 hours. It was no problem, and that he was very comfortable, and it was no sense of burnout because of being able to express that or dwell in that quality of compassion. So I thought that was really interesting that when he was told to just worry and feel bad about the suffering of others, then he felt burnt out. But as soon as he was able to follow his own natural sense of compassion and well-wishing towards others, then it was not exhausting at all. And so in terms of dealing with the drought situation and the suffering of beings here in this region, I feel that's a good snapshot of what's helpful advice. So as long as the mind dwells on all of the suffering, and oh dear, this is so awful, and there's this and there's this, the long list of all the terrible things that are happening, and the mind dwells on just on the negative side of it, then you're going to get burnt out and it's going to feel really stressful and difficult. But his account suggests is that if we don't simply let the mind dwell on all of that pain, but receiving and knowing that pain, or appreciating that painfulness, but then allowing that to bring forth the quality of caring, not in terms of more stressful thoughts, but the genuine quality of compassion, then that's something that is liberating. And this we've done a number of sessions here, and I suspect this is a regular theme here at Yomo in these classes. But in terms of Buddhist psychology, compassion, if you're suffering on account of another being suffering, that's a distorted kind of compassion. So karuna, or compassion, is not a state of suffering. Even though the English word means to, compassion means to suffer with. In Buddhist psychology, karuna is not a state of suffering. You're attuning to the suffering of others, but karuna is a great brightness of heart. It's one of the immeasurable bright mind states, what are called the Brahma Viharas, or the divine abidings. So that compassion, and I felt that was, I'm not quite sure how many people in the room could really get it when he when he said that, but compassion is a great radiance of the heart. It's a great brightness. It's not just feeling miserable on account of the misery of others, but rather, if you are feeling miserable, then that's an indication, there's a degree of grasping, of identification, and stressing over that. But when compassion is purified and really developed in a full way, there's no sense of self in it. There's no suffering being created in our own heart on account of that. There's an empathizing, there's an attunement to the condition of others, but you're not creating suffering on account of that within yourself. And maybe that's something to discuss when we have the time for Q&A, but I felt that was a really helpful statement to make. And also how when he was able to dwell and abide in that state of karuna, of compassion, that he was not tired, he was not burnt out, he was not stressed. It was, I was very happy. For 2 or 3 hours I could do that, no problem. And he really lit up as he said that. It was like it was really obvious that it wasn't just a theoretical thing, but the felt experience of it was in that way. And maybe the last thing to mention, just in case some of you are thinking, who is this monk anyway that he's talking about? That I did see some very interesting graphs of the people who had done compassion practice being sort of having their brainwaves taken. And there was a bell curve, from the sort of undergrads out of the coffee bar who were tested, through people who are more experienced meditators to ones who are quite experienced meditators. And there was a kind of natural bell curve. And then the Matthieu Ricard's, when they rigged him up and they asked him, okay, now please put your mind onto compassion. He was like several units off the end of the bell curve, where his capacity to just put his mind into that kind of a state. So he is obviously an exceptional being, but I would say even though he is a bit exceptional, that capacity is there for all of us. And I would say, and knowing that, even as you find yourself stressing or getting caught up, just to bring that to mind, it is possible to have compassion for others without creating suffering in myself. That is possible. And even just that suggestion and reminding yourself of that can have a liberating effect and help you to the mind to let go of that, the selfing around that, the kind of self-creating self-view and self-centered thinking around that. And then you can feel and know that quality of compassion and care for yourself, and that caring as a great radiance and a great spaciousness, rather than just a quality of stress or burden. So I will leave things there and offer these thoughts for consideration, and we can open things up for some discussion.